Welcome to Breaking Doctrine, presented to you by the Combined Arms Doctrine Directorate at the Combined Arms Center at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. The views expressed here are those of the individual and do not represent the views of the Combined Arms Center, U.S. Army, or U.S. government.
Welcome to Breaking Doctrine, a U.S. Army Combined Arms Center podcast on emerging doctrine and the Army's vision of warfare. Hello, I'm Lieutenant Colonel Lisa Becker, and today's podcast episode is Stewarding the Profession, the Harding Project. We welcome to the show Lieutenant Colonel Zach Griffiths, Career Special Forces Officer and Director of the Harding Project. We also welcome Dr. Trent Lithgow, a retired Army Aviation Officer, now serving as a professor in the Department of Leadership at the Command and General Staff College. Finally, we welcome back to the show our director here at CAD, Colonel Retired Rich Creed. Gentlemen, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Lisa. Good to be here.
Thanks, Lisa.
So I understand that all of you have some sort of passion for writing. So how or where did you get this interest? Trent, could you start us off?
Sure. For me, it was a little bit involuntary when I started my graduate work, my PhD, because you have to write a lot. And so whether you like it or not, you have to get good at it, producing a lot of content that's reasonably good. So that's where I started. And then once I started teaching at the CGSC, I really noticed that we had a need to improve the writing of our students as professionals. And so I really started investigating how can we do that well.
You know, Lisa, when I was a captain in my Special Forces Battalion, I kind of had this inclination or thought that I should write and capture some of the lessons. But like Trent, it wasn't until I went to graduate school and I took a class on writing. It was 6 weeks, and it kind of trained me on how to do it. And then I felt much more confident. And so part of that is the reason I feel like the Army can bring people in that may be on the fence. There's some pool of folks out there that just haven't taken that first step. And so I hope that through the Harding Project and some reformed education objectives in PME, we're able to give people the tools so they're like confident to take that first step.
Yeah, I just started. I mean, I was smiling to myself. Sister Mary Gregory in seventh grade at St. Thomas More Cathedral School in Arlington, Virginia, probably got me off to the races. And frankly, I was a history major in college because I really didn't like calculus. But I liked the ideas. I was always a history buff. And when you read a lot, then I think you've got some sort of instinct for writing a lot because you've got a lot of examples, right? And it's not that I was ever a passionate writer. But when there's professional topics in particular that get me fired up, then I feel like, hey, I need to contribute something to either better understanding or present a point of view. And the only way you can do that is through writing. I mean, you could talk, but people forget. That's not enduring. Writing endures a little bit. So I think that's why I had an interest in it.
You know, Mr. Creed just kind of gave us the point that he studied history, but I studied applied math. There's no one person or one background, right? They can make you a writer. And so I think it is about having that kind of inclination and then that drive. You see something, you feel like you need to say something or capture an insight.
Yeah.
Thanks. So let's start off the conversation, Zach, with what is the Harding Project? Could you tell our listeners about that?
Yeah. So the Harding Project is an effort to renew the system of professional writing in the United States Army. And so a lot of that is some kind of behind the scenes, you know, institutional reform work, but we also do outreach. And so quickly, our first point is on modernization of the platform. And so we're going to move all the Army's journals, like Infantry, Aviation Digest, to a web-first, mobile-friendly platform supported by social media. So this is much more like the Modern War Institute or War on the Rocks than it is like a print quarterly that shows up in your day room. Well, I still think print has a ton of value. We're really trying to reach that scrolling soldier. When they're on their phone, they click on a link and it can take them right to the article that they want to read and of interest. So that's the first part is the modernization. The second related to that is on the archives. And so this is like looking into our past. Armor starts as cavalry in 1888. Infantry starts in 1930 under Forrest Harding, who we draw our inspiration from at the infantry school. And so there's a long history here. And if you dig into those archives, you'll find like tons of content that's relevant to today, or you help see what people were thinking at the time. And so making those archives accessible, I think will help some of the work you guys do here at the Combined Arms Doctrine Directorate. We're also looking at staffing. Maybe like 30 years ago, all the journals in the Army were maybe at 5 to 7 staff, led by a couple of uniform folks, and then with some talented civilians to help. And now that staff has been cut basically to 0, maybe 1 or 2. with almost no uniformed folks involved. And so we're trying to right-size that, and the goal is to get to one uniform and two civilians per journal. We've already identified one uniform per one, basically captain or junior major per journal, and so they're going to be starting this summer. So it's a kind of an early win for the Harding Project here. And then the last is on education. And so this is just making sure that all Army professionals know these journals exist, and then hopefully inspire in them the desire to write. Now, we're also looking at expanding some of the scholars programs to like the Sergeant's Major Academy. They'll be piloting the Ultima Scholars Program this summer that will invest in senior non-commissioned officers that have the aptitude and inclination to write. And so those are kind of like those behind-the-scenes institutional reforms that we're working on. But also we do outreach. And so Dr. Lithgow is contributing to our special issue of Military Review that we'll publish in August or so. That's the Harding Project. Lisa.
So you work for the Chief of Staff of the Army, General George. And did he bring you up because one of his focus areas is stewing the profession?
Yeah, absolutely. So General George has four focus areas, and stewing the profession is the one that we nest most cleanly under. And so I had written some articles on why I thought the Army's journals should change and be renewed. So General George saw those and invited me to come help work on this effort for his team. So I've been doing this work really since August of last year.
Did you notice, just based on your interest and your passion, a decline in the journals, or was that something the chief did, or do you think this was some sort of informal consensus that came from multiple points? Because it's one I strongly agree with.
Yeah, so it actually started because I was frustrated with my branch magazine, which was Special Warfare. And I collected a bunch of data on Special Warfare to kind of assess its health. And ultimately, I tried to share that with the Special Warfare Center in school. We had a little bit of traction, and then some people changed. And this was maybe in 2019. But then I had the insight that like maybe this wasn't a Special Warfare problem, but like an Army problem. And so this is like a really lame thing to do, but I collected a ton of data on the health of the Army's journals. I collected data on number of pages published per issue, per year, number of authors, the staffing over time. You look at the masthead that's on every issue. And so I was able to show, right, that the Army's journals published less content less often and more erratically with reduced staffs over the last 40 years, which is kind of as much as data was available.
So the math came in handy.
You can chart it quite clearly and show that there's just that decline. And so, you know, I applied a bunch of tools that I had the good fortune to learn in grad school to this and make a case for why I thought, and also why I thought this would work.
Now, this isn't the first time that we've talked about the link between doctrine and professional writing or professional journals or professional publications on our podcast before. Listeners can check out episode 28 and episode 44, where we had conversations with the Army University Press on this connection. Central to our conversation today is the Army profession and our obligation as Army professionals. So, Mr. Cree, could you outline the doctrine that talks about the Army profession and maybe talk about how that links to professional writing?
Yeah, so Army Doctrinal Publication 622 is called the Army Profession and Leadership, and it's actually renamed. Well, we used to call it just leadership. And we took a standalone profession book back in 2019 and the standalone leadership book, and we combined the two. And we did it. There was a pretty simple logical reason for it, in that the discussions of the profession and the Army profession specifically. We had created a book that had all these redundancies, and the other piece was we never did a good job of explicitly linking leadership to the profession, right? And it gets back to the old General Perkins saying, "What are you for?" Well, what we're for is a profession that's dedicated to defending and supporting the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, foundationally. So what we did is we organized the book to address what the profession is, what it's for up front, and then how leaders fit into it. There's rules about professions, and professions exist to provide some sort of unique skill set that betters the society. And in our case, it helps protect our society, right? So it's more than just the job, and it builds this community of people who are not just developing the intellectual foundations, but protecting them, refining them, and adapting them as the world changes. And so linking that to professional writing is pretty straightforward. because professional writing is foundational to our intellectual development. You know, the writing itself creates intellectual because you learn when you write. You have to do research. You've got to get your facts straight. You're trying to make a contribution that moves the profession along because the world's not static, right? And so the profession has to adapt to remain relevant, right, to the world around us. But it's really the writing, the professional discourse, the leader development and so forth that allows the profession to adapt to the new challenges and the circumstances around us.
Yeah, I think, you know, to your point, you know, Huntington and Soldier of State talks about professions having expertise, corporateness, and responsibility. But, you know, on the corporateness and expertise, you know, he also talks about you should be able to put it in writing if you're a profession. And so certainly doctrine, what you guys do here at CAD, is a huge part of developing that expertise and that body of knowledge. But the journals have a really important part in helping us debate, surface new issues, and those types of things to get it in. So I appreciate your comments, Mr. Peek.
Yeah, professional discourse, what's foundational to that is intellectual honesty and the willingness to listen and to say, hey, somebody's identified something needs to change or that we have a problem, right? Or that we're not doing something as well as we assume that we're doing. Because really, when you get down to it, the professional discourse questions assumptions. But we also have to be open to criticism. And professions that don't internally critique themselves or even accept that external criticisms and then bring it in, those criticisms into the profession and then mull them over, I think they have a real problem.
Yeah, I think in the chief's initial kind of call for professional discourse last fall, it was the chief, John Brito, and SMA Weimer, and they sort of explicitly called for questioning of like those sacred cows.
You know? Yeah.
So that's in there. But if you write an article for publication, you know, you enter that idea into the record forever, right? And so that is why, part of the reason why it's so important to write these things down, because you're contributing to that professional expertise. Even if the idea is discarded now, it might be relevant in 20 years or in 50 years. And so it's important to make those publications.
Or somebody else sees it and they say, well, these are the critiques of your new idea. And what you start is this back and forth. Somebody's going to agree with you. Somebody's going to disagree with you. Somebody will be somewhere in the middle. That's the power of this, is it starts this back and forth. And I think that happens on blogs and in professional listservs. Like I've signed all our team up for over a variety of professional listservs, listservers. But that doesn't get captured, like to your point. Right. I mean, you could go back into a server somewhere and pull these things out, but it's not touching anybody that's not part of that conversation.
I think that's the key to professional discourse. And a lot of people sometimes don't understand that. And they feel like, well, I need to write an article that changes the world or changes doctrine or something like that. Right. And that rarely happens. Occasionally, there are those sort of seminal works. But more often what you're doing is you're entering a conversation with other professionals. And it's really conversations that change professions over time. It's rarely kind of the individual article or piece.
Well, it's steel sharpens steel. And I think there is a reluctance among some people because they're afraid to put themselves out there. Then they write and they get critiqued and they get their feelings hurt or they feel like, well, I may have caused a little bit of a stir here. When in actuality, they're doing the profession a benefit.
You know, to your point about people being nervous to take that first step, you know, I did a survey of military authors, and the overwhelming consensus was it was either good for their careers or made no impact. And so it really is worth doing and putting yourself out there. The implications are rarely, almost never bad.
Right.
Yeah. Later in the podcast, I want to get a little bit more, talk a little bit more about professional discourse and putting yourself out there, the benefits of writing. But first, I want to talk about how we get there, how we write. So Trent, I think you're in a really unique position down at the Command and General Staff College. I know you were the project editor for professional writing, the Command and General Staff College Writing Guide. So could you walk us through the genesis of why you wrote this writing guide?
So if I'm honest, it started off because I grade over 140 essays a year, and there were a lot of bad essays. So I wanted to grade fewer bad essays. So I started looking at, I mean, the broader issue is that our officers struggle to write well, broadly. I think that's a pretty well-accepted assertion. And so I asked, why is that the case? And I looked at, and how can we help here at the CGSC? So I looked at what our current guidance was in terms of what we were teaching our students. And I found that it aligned with the Army's writing guidance in some sense, in that it was very product focused. And it said, here's good writing, uses the active voice. It's short, it's easy to read, it's concise, it's clear. It avoids jargon, all those things. There's a brief list in the Army regulation 25-50. The problem with our guide is that it kind of repeated that, and then it kind of focused on academic writing. And we were really saying to our students, here's enough about academic writing to get you through your year at CGSC. And I didn't think any of either of those things were good. The first problem with it is that writing isn't a product, it's a process. And so to write well involves mastering the process. And then, of course, I didn't think that the focus on academic writing was right. We're a professional school. We educate and train professionals. And so I felt that we owed it to our students to give them a writing process that was mostly focused on what they do when they leave the CGSC. So certainly it's a process that they can use for academic writing, but the title professional writing is intentional because it is about the profession and writing as a professional. And then the last thing that I saw is it was largely self-referential. So there were 8 sources in our writing guide. It was really a chapter in another publication. So we really put some research into this and went out and found what are the best practices out there. What's the research tell us about how to write and those kinds of things. The most current copy, change 1 to June 2024, it incorporates guidance on artificial intelligence using AI in writing. It has 83 sources. So we've more than 10 times the number of sources of the original. So we've really tried to reach out into the broader academic community and research to make a really effective writing guide for our students.
Awesome. One thing that I really like about it is the beginning is not this checklist. The beginning talks about myths of writing. So could you go over some of those myths of writing?
Sure. The reason I included those in there, the committee, is that when we approach students who struggle with their writing, we often find it's less about their skills and more about what they believe about writing. And so the first step to writing well, I think, is changing your beliefs. The first one, which is widespread, is that writing is a gift. So people will say, well, I'm not a good writer. Well, that's not how writing works. It's not a talent or a gift. It's a craft. It's a skill. And so if you want to improve it, you can learn to do it well. There's some well-known, well-established strategies based on, you know, cognitive science that you can use to write well so that people can understand it. So I think that's the first myth, is believing that you can get better at it. It's not just a gift. The second one is that writing is easy for good writers. The fact is that writing's hard for everybody. I've been doing it for several years and it's still hard. It gets easier the more you practice, but it never gets easy.
Is it easier just because you're understanding the process? Going back to that process piece.
Yes, because you get better at the process. I'm happy to talk about the process a little bit, but just briefly, one of the reasons that people struggle is they don't understand that at certain points in the process, you need to focus on certain things and not focus on other things. So one of the most common problems, as an example, is that when people are drafting, they'll stop and edit as they go. What we teach our students is don't do that. The idea behind drafting is to get the ideas on the page, let them rest, and then in revision, you actually come back to them and wrestle with the ideas a little bit and clarify your thinking. The getting to sentences and words isn't until editing, which is pretty far down the road, right? So if you can learn to apply the process and ignore some things and focus on other things, it does get easier because if nothing else, you become a more efficient writer.
Okay.
But it's never easy.
I think that's brilliant. That's exactly what we try to tell new doctrine writers. Hey, stop worrying about how you're going to do it. Get the ideas in there. Do the work to get the ideas right. And once you get the ideas right, the rest is iterative and collaborative.
The last myth I would mention is on feedback. So people a lot of times assume feedback with being in school or getting a grade or something like that. And so they're like, oh, well, when you become a professional, you know, if you're a strong writer, you don't need feedback. Everybody needs feedback. There's something in writing called the curse of knowledge, which is when you research your topic, you know a lot about it. And when you write about it, then it's hard to imagine not knowing about it. And so your brain fills in the gaps. But you have to write in a way where you're explaining it to your reader who may be hearing this for the first time. If your work is pretty original, they are hearing it for the first time. So there are some strategies to overcome the curse of knowledge. But the best one is to give it to somebody else and let them read it. And they will tell you, like, this just does not make sense. And so feedback is critical throughout the writing process. As we talked about before, it's critical to professional discourse as well. And so it's good as a professional just to get used to accepting criticism. It's hard. Nobody likes to be criticized. When I talk to my students about it, we have two competing psychological demands and emotional demands. One is to be accepted as we are and being told, you're okay, you're good. The other one is to learn and grow. And to learn and grow, you have to be told, you're not as good as you need to be. You need to do this better. And so we have to decide that wanting to learn and grow through critical feedback is more important than the good feeling we get by being told that you did a good job, right? We all kind of want that, but that desire, like, I want critical feedback, it stings, but I know it's good for me, is critical to becoming a good writer, I think.
You know, Trent, one myth I think that some writers have is, like, that this could be done really quickly. And I know all of your audience here are students at CGSC, but, you know, a lot of the writing projects that I do last for months or years. That can be frustrating to a new writer. And certainly some projects can be quite quick. But it's that iteration that takes time in developing the idea.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, and it takes time, I think, for a couple of reasons. Number one, if you've written at all, you know the value in resting a piece of writing. Because when you get done with that draft, you think, wow, that's awesome. And then you come back to it 3 days later and you're like, ooh, that's not as awesome as I thought.
What was I thinking?
Yeah, exactly. And then the thinking actually is, I think, the other piece is that people think, well, I need to do all my thinking and then do my writing. Really, those things happen at the same time.
And this is actually a crucial difference, too, from professional discourse or writing for the Army's journals and, like, social media. Captain Theolipsky is a great friend and helps launch this project. And he, writes about how Twitter won't steward the profession. It's the name of Honorable Hero for War on the Rocks. But, you know, some of those quick hits or responses feel good. It actually may have some good insights. But taking the time to be more disciplined and seek feedback leads you to a more finished product, which is, like, better to enter into the record than just some, like, quick responses.
So, Trent, you've kind of talked about this process already. It, you know, all of you have hit on it, but could you give some maybe concrete examples of how to get better at writing or feel comfortable about writing?
Yeah, well, I think Rich mentioned one earlier, which is read. Read widely. The more you read both good and bad writing, the better you'll get at it. I also advise my students, though, to read like a writer. And there's a difference between reading like a writer and a reader. Reading like a reader is reading to get the content. To understand what you're trying to understand or be entertained, if that's what you're reading for. But reading like a writer is reading to understand choices. So writing isn't about following rules. It's about making good choices. And reading like a writer means reading to pay attention to how did the writer organize their argument? Why did they choose this sentence instead of that sentence? Why did they choose this word instead of that word? And then asking yourself, are these choices effective? And if they are, how can I make similar choices in my writing? If they're not, how can I make more effective choices in my writing? So reading widely and reading like a reader is one. And number two, we just talked about, get feedback throughout the writing process and not just at the end. And then the last thing we, again, already talked about that, this is getting comfortable being uncomfortable. So writing is never easy. It's rewarding, but it's never really comfortable. So just get used to the discomfort and you kind of live with it.
I think one of the most important things that any professional military officer who wants to write and communicate ideas, a benefit is to read really good fiction. Because really good fiction communicates, in many cases, very complicated things and storylines and plot lines. And they may have a lot of technology, think Tom Clancy or somebody like Harold Coyle. But you never got lost in all that technical stuff. The technical stuff there was communicated in such a way to make it exciting, make it readable, make it something that you want to read more.
But if you don't read like a writer and see how they do that, then you can just end up communicating a bunch of very dry stuff, which nobody wants to read. So I think that being able to tell a good story is as applicable to professional writing as it is to, you know, somebody that's writing bestsellers on the New York Times list.
Lisa, I really push book reviews for first-time writers because they do help you read like a writer. Is that was the word we used, Trent? Yeah. And think critically about the book. They're also short. They're relatively easy to publish. I recently wrote How to Write a Book Review for Baltieri Review, so you can find that if you Google it. But they're relatively formulaic, pretty easy way to get started. And it would be remiss if I don't plug, again, the special issue of Baltieri Review that we'll have coming out in August, which is just full of how-to guides. It is literally aimed at the first-time author, for unit leaders who are trying to start a kind of a culture of writing or professional discourse in their unit. And so it'll be coming out in August, and you should have a ton of great resources.
So, you know, everybody's talked about writing being a process. So I think that takes time. You know, that's time is what comes to mind with that. And we know that everyone in the force is strapped for time. So what do you say to someone who gives that excuse? I don't have time for this.
Sure. So I think there are two issues when people talk about not having time to write. The first is, how do I write well when I'm writing a lot of like short form stuff on a daily basis, like emails, right? The kind of the irony of the modern world is we are collectively all struggling to write, but we're writing more collectively than we ever have, you know, through like emails and texts and things like that. It's just not very good writing. So how do you write well in that short format? I would say, number one, you can't, as I was saying earlier, underestimate the benefit of rest. If you can rest that email and send it tomorrow, do it. So I like doing a lot of drafts. My technique is I'll do a lot of drafts in the morning and then maybe revise them in the afternoon and send them, or draft them one day, send them the next day. Some emails and short form stuff, you need to have it today. You need to have it right now or yesterday, right? And so I use a technique called a draft and a half. And a draft and a half works like this. You draft the email or whatever it is you're going to write, and then you do one revision, and that revision focuses on two things. Number one, you find the bottom line, what the conclusion is, the main idea, and you move it to the front and state it clearly, make it the first sentence. And then number two is removing the clutter. Anything that's redundant, any word that's unnecessary, any of that stuff, any long word that could be a short word, get rid of all the clutter and then send it.
I love the thought of email. Everybody writes emails every day. And thinking about that, and that's writing, and that's going to give you reps every single day.
Well, but that, we've talked about this before. That's part of stewarding the profession. You teach your subordinates what a correct email looks like. Bottom line up front, just the information they need. And oh, by the way, the more senior the person you're dealing with, the less clutter they need. They need the bottom line up front. Hey, boss, this is why this is important. But you enforce that in your discourse back and forth with them, which means you have to set the right example for it as well.
Yeah, so I think, you know, you point out, Lisa, that email is a good opportunity to kind of get some reps. And even though it's a short process, it is a process, right? And that process is you draft, you rest, and you revise. The other thing I would kind of add on to what Rich was saying is that when you become a more senior officer, you know, field grade officer, as all of us here know, a lot of times the interactions you have with your senior rater are mostly written. You know, when I was at TRADOC headquarters, it was rare that I was actually up front briefing somebody like I was as a junior officer. I was writing information papers. I was writing emails. I once got a task to write a ghost email, an email on behalf of General Perkins, for General Milley, endorsing this capability that we were going after, this aviation capability. And my boss's boss, who was a two-star general, said, keep it at the four-star level, which to me translated into make an argument, make TRADOC's argument for this capability in 2 to 3 sentences. So I tell my students, if you think making an argument in 5 pages is hard, try making it in 3 sentences, right? So the idea of like clarity and brevity and all those things really hits home at that point. And that's definitely an email that there was a lot of effort in those 3 sentences. But to the previous question, the second issue about having more time, I think, is, you know, everybody's busy. So when do you have time to write a professional article? And for me, that's not really a question of time, because we all have the same amount of time. That's not changing. It's a question of priority. So what does your boss think is important? If your commander thinks that writing is important, then they're going to provide the right incentives and create the right culture to drive people to contribute and to write. And if they don't think it's important, then it won't.
As I say, you know, a couple of thoughts on that. You know, I did mention, I think writing often takes time, but book reviews as a way to get started and build momentum, right? You're going to get a deadline and it's probably going to be 6 weeks. And so that deadline can help, you know, if once you've agreed to do it, hey, I got 6 weeks, and that can help move you along on that process. Another insight is like most ideas for professional journals are evergreen, and that like, yeah, they're like sort of timely, but they don't need to be this week or tomorrow. They could be any time really over the next couple of weeks.
I think the other thing that's important is passion. I think we have to be careful and not say, hey, I just need you to get out there and start writing stuff. Because what happens is that turns everybody off. People will commit, they will make time. They will go the extra mile, because what we're saying is when you say make time, it means you're doing it in your free time. You're doing it when you're not in the office or you're down in the motor pool. You're doing it because you care. So you have to have a topic that you care about, because that's the only way you're going to have the motivation to see it through. So that gets to your point about evergreen topics, because there are a lot of things that don't change, but maybe we forget. And so now it's time for somebody to reemphasize an old idea, but adjust it for the contemporary era.
Yeah. You know, I'd say, you know, Lisa asked, how is this sort of part of strengthening the profession? And to me, like, the real thing I'm trying to convince folks by doing this work is like that they, as professionals, have agency in the Army, and that what they write matters and will make a difference to the way the Army fights or administers itself or whatever. And so, yeah, I mean, it's a question of prioritization and passion and these things, but like it does and it can work. But I hope that professionals, and as the Army strengthens, believe they have agency, can fix the Army, make it better, and they write.
I think this goes back to, as well, what we kind of opened with was linking this to the profession. Who is the arbiter of what constitutes the professional's body of knowledge? It's the professionals, right? If you look at other professions, you know, when you pass the bar as a lawyer, who gets to say that you pass the bar or you get disbarred? Other lawyers, right? There's no executive committee. It's peers. And so it's very much the same with professionals. So as professionals, it's not, you know, let's get a checklist, or I want everybody to write an article by the end of the fiscal year or something like that. It's how do we cultivate a culture in which, as professionals, people feel an obligation, not because they're going to get reward, although they may, not because it's going to advance their career, although it might, but because we have a professional obligation to contribute to the profession's body of knowledge. Professionals, true professionals, feel that. And if they feel that, then, as Rich said, they'll make time for it.
Well, you're analyzing ideas to make arguments. And a profession is dead if you cannot promote good ideas and kill bad ones. But it requires analysis to know the difference between the two. And you've got to be willing to allow, in some cases, junior people to speak up and say, hey, I know this is the way we've done things for X number of decades or years or whatever, but it's not working. And unless people are willing to speak up, and it's not always bottom-up or top-down. It can be both. But if we're not honest and we don't allow people to disagree and argue respectfully, we're not going to ever address what the chief wants us to address. In a hierarchical organization like the Army, you run a real risk to the profession if the loudest, most senior voice in the room is always prevailing and there is no brooking of counterpoints or different approaches. And that gets all armies in trouble, and we're no different. I mean, that can really cause a problem where someone says, we're just going to do this because I said so, and we're not having a conversation about the why, the background story. You need to make the case, because we're talking, in many cases, from an Army perspective, billions of dollars, tens of thousands of people, decisions that will affect U.S. national security. And, you know, it could get people killed. And so, I mean, we got to make sure we're right. I mean, a profession has to make sure it's right. So I just think that that's a big deal, because the profession and professional discourse is the antibody to a top-down, rigid approach to things that's not intellectually well informed.
You know, I think one thing that we that we take for granted about our system of journalists is like how free we are to speak in the U.S. Army. And so it really is something that, you know, we need to steward as members of the profession is our ability to be able to speak truth, you know, to power, because it really is unusual. And it's something that I think is a great gift that we have in the United States Army.
I agree.
So we've talked this whole episode about writing about, you know, that gift that we have. What about making sure that people are actually reading what's written? How do we make sure that there's readers out there?
You know, so, you know, as I think I said, accessibility is one of the big platforms of the Harding Project. And so I firmly believe, having seen the examples of the Modern War Institute and War on the Rocks, that both launched in 2013, 2014, something like that, and now have like tens of thousands of readers, that accessibility helps. And then quality content is the other part of this. And so that's part of the reason why we're putting captains, you know, senior captains at each one of the journals, is to make sure that the content is relevant that to the people in the field. You know, they know their peers, you know, and so they're able to bring in young authors who have new ideas. And so it's very much, I think those uniforms have a really important job of stewarding, you know, that journal for their branch. And so that's how we think about accessibility and quality. And I think that will lead to more readers. You know, the last thing is trying to broaden our writer base, I think will also help. Sergeant Major of the Army Weimer made it quite clear that he expects non-commissioned officers to write. He's launching Muddy Boots Forum, which is going to like, kind of promote this among senior non-commissioned officers and all non-commissioned officers. And, you know, my partner in crime in this effort is Sergeant First Class Leighton Summerlin. But, you know, we really do hope to broaden the base, which I think will also bring in more readers.
And I'll go old school. So I agree with everything you said. But we have a professional obligation to make people read. And so you're a company commander. You're a battalion commander, you're a brigade commander. You have the authority using your leadership development programs to make people read. What we used to do in both battalion and brigades I commanded was I would alternate leader development programs every month. So one was some professional Army thing, right? Command supply discipline or the maintenance program or something. But every other month, you had to read a book. You didn't have to do a report. You had to read the book because then all 50 or 60 or 70 officers, we'd all get together for an afternoon, and we would talk about the book. And I would have some questions up there. And again, nobody was getting tested. And what you found was you could go around the room, and you could tell who'd read it and who didn't read it, like right off the bat. But you could tell people who could understand it and didn't understand it. And what it did was it actually allowed you to see your officers in a different way than you would have ordinarily. Because the writing and the ability to understand the writing, well, because you made them read it, was a tool for kind of getting a 360 view of the individual. And I found that very useful. Plus, most people really enjoy those conversations because there's no rank in them, right? I'm in charge. I'm facilitating the conversation, but it's like, what do you think? What do you think? Who's got thoughts on this?
One of our points is to look at the education system. One low-cost intervention that's been approved for NCOPME already is like a citation requirement where they have to cite their professional journal as they write, you know, some battle analysis or whatever the assignment is, right? Because that for, you know, any citation is like roughly, you know, 5 to 8 articles you have to read. And so by adding a citation requirement to cite Aviation Digest or Infantry or Armor, you force people to get into those journals and be familiar with them. We're also standing up, or not me, but, you know, Army University Press that we've talked about a little bit here with Colonel Schmidt, who's been a great partner, is standing up what we're calling the line of departure. And so this will be a web platform that consolidates all the Army's journals and kind of in separate verticals. And so this will be that web-first, mobile-friendly platform. And so Armor will be alongside Infantry, will be alongside Aviation Digest. And if, you know, Lisa writes an article about integration of Blackhawks and Infantry, right? You could run that in both verticals. You know, Infantry can get that article and Aviation Digest. But right now, you get very little cross-publications.
Yeah, Todd Schmidt and his team at Army University Press have done wonderful things.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's pretty neat.
We've really focused this discussion on officers and some in NCO initiatives. Can you talk, you know, can we broaden that conversation to warrant officers and NCOs?
Yeah, I mean, certainly the way we approach this is not at all, you know, on an officer front. SMA Weimer made it really clear he wanted someone to be pushing this on the NCO side. Our first workshop in the fall, we had representatives from the Warrant Officer Career College, from the Sergeant's Major Academy, Nickel Co., We've actually had some of our best success working through NICOLCO to get educational reform done. They've been really good partners. They're the ones that are standing up the pilot for the scholars program. They're the ones that have gotten a citation requirement implemented. And so we've seen some really great success there. The NCO Journal started about 30 years ago, and it's been, I think, leads the Army in accessibility. It's web first. It's mobile friendly. You can listen to their content. They run a great podcast, right? So I think we have a ton of lessons to be learned here from the NCO side. And we try, and I use them as examples all the time, or people that are, and they have a dedicated force structure. They have two uniform NCOs that work there when no other journal in the Army does, right? So the NCOs, I think, are very much leading here, and the officers have something to learn from the work that they're doing as we think about renewing all of the Army's journals.
Okay, thanks. That's all the questions that I have for you. Do you have any last parting comments before we wrap up?
You know, I would invite everyone to follow us. We have a, if you're interested in this topic, we run the HardingProject.com Substack. And if you're interested in submitting, we take posts about 800 words, really focused on professional writing, right? If you're writing about a branch issue, submit it to your branch journal, to Military Review. But if you have something to say about writing, we take, of course, dissenting opinions. Anyone, you know, would love your feedback. And then look for that special issue in August. It's going to come out digitally. We'll do a pretty big rollout for it. But then we're also printing issues and sending them to units across the Army so that folks will have those references on hand for unit development programs or just if you're, you know, waiting to talk to your commander. So, yeah, Harding Project, follow us, and we look forward to working with you in the future.
Yeah, I would just kind of do a plug for Student Text 22-2, the Professional Writing Guide. Although it says student text, it's for, we really wrote it for everyone in the Army. And my secret hope is that somewhere in the Army, an XO or an S3 is getting, you know, maybe a not very good writing project and is handing a copy of that to a young captain. And so that when they get to the CGSC, they'll have already seen it. And then the last thing I would add, just to kind of going back to the question of, you know, what's the Harding Project about? And I think more broadly, professional writing. For me, it's about thinking as an academic and a professional military academic. You know, my business is all thinking and improving people's ability to think. And I think writing does that like nothing else. There's an influential communications theory in when you think about visual media that talks about how do you influence people. One of the ways is through the substance of what's being communicated, and the other way is through the surface level stuff, like how professional are they, how funny are they, right? When you do a briefing, a lot of times you can buy some credibility by looking the part and by speaking the part without actually sometimes having a substantive argument. And I think the real power of writing and why it's not just communicating said another way, it's not just another form of briefing, is because you don't get that. You don't get to be there with the reader. And if there are deficiencies in your thinking, writing is ruthless about laying those bare. You will not get away with it like you will in a briefing or somewhere else. And so I think it's really the key to improving thinking among our leaders in the Army is making them write well, because it is all about what's going on in their brain. So I'm excited about it.
I think the health of our profession is measured by the level of dynamic engagement in our business, and writing is a really straightforward way to measure that level of engagement. And I really appreciate what both Trent and Zach do and have done to this point. Trent is well known here in CAD. He's published some things that we have taken to heart and have actually introduced, you know, some of the techniques that he's talked about here today in terms of making our doctrine better. So both of you guys are doing things that are make a huge difference in the profession of arms. So I just want to thank you both for being here, because this was a lot of fun.
Thank you. Thanks, Lisa.
Just like writing new doctrine is a team effort, breaking doctrine takes a team. Without the crew and special doctrine division here at CAD, we wouldn't be able to bring you this show. Our production is coordinated by Mr. Ted Crisco, and our editing and sound is provided by 29 Pixel Studios. Please don't forget to subscribe on YouTube, Apple, Audible, or Spotify podcasts, and follow us on social media at U.S. Army Doctrine to get updates on new podcasts, Doctrine Digest videos, and publications. Finally, the views and opinions expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect the official position of the United States Army, U.S. Army Training and Doctrine Command, or the Combined Arms Center. I'm Lieutenant Colonel Lisa Becker, and this has been Breaking Doctrine.